Hello, welcome. My name is Anna. If we haven't met before, it's really good to see you. I'm one of the two staff members of KXC that are left in London. The rest of them have gone off to New Wine, and it does feel a little bit like the adults have gone away and they've just left the kids to play. And we could actually, if we wanted to, if we all agreed it, we could just pop to Camino now and just sack off the talk. Pete Hughes would never know. Anyway, we shan't do that because I have prepared something, and that would just be awkward. Anyway, and Colin, our lovely, our resident comedian Colin, felt that because we had a slight kerfuffle, I'd say, trying to put all these three services on, he decided to change the tagline of New Wine's vision statement from "Local churches changing nations" to "Local churches struggling to run their Sunday services." So here we are, we're here together, having fun. Anyway, so today, my talk is titled Tales of Total Forgiveness, and I stole the title from a book by R.T. Kendall, which is a book I read when I first became a Christian. And it's a book of basically stories of people who have just forgiven in the most horrific circumstances. And I absolutely love it as a book. It had a profound impact on me. And one of the things I think that's so amazing about the book and about the stories is that there's something so wrong about forgiveness, isn't there? There's something so, like, oh gosh, startling about it, because when it's totally unjust, isn't it? Someone being forgiven for something that actually they totally don't deserve. It's like, wow, that's unusual, because, for example, you know, we have laws, because if someone does something wrong, they get punished for it. But forgiveness works in the total opposite way, and we're talking today about tales of total forgiveness, that we get to tell tales of total forgiveness. And in the prayer that we just said, the Lord's Prayer, it says this line, "Forgive us our debts as we have also forgiven our debtors." And right there are two tales of total forgiveness. That we are totally and utterly forgiven by God. Totally and utterly, totally forgiven by Him. And we get to participate in that story of receiving that forgiveness. And the other thing is that actually we get to totally forgive other people, and we get to tell those tales. So that's what we're going to look at today. And we're going to be going through parts of Matthew to do that. And we're going to start in this prayer. And this prayer is... probably wasn't fully originally Jesus' prayer, which is quite interesting. And the hearers would have actually recognized some of it, because it's familiar to a prayer called the Kaddish. And the Kaddish is actually a prayer associated with mourning. And there's aspects of this prayer, when you read it, you think, gosh, actually there is this sense of mourning. For example, it says, "Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." Which suggests that actually God's kingdom isn't fully realized, that it's being frustrated by something. That there's a desperation in that prayer to say, actually, we want to see your order, your kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. And also it says, "Give us our daily bread." And this would have been familiar to the Israelites, because they would have been thinking immediately of the Israelites in the story of Exodus, where they were going through the desert and they had to rely on God on a daily basis for their food, that He gave them food from heaven. And every day they were instructed to go out and get their food. They weren't to take too much and they weren't to take too little. And they were to depend every day and trust that He would give them what they needed. And it also says that, "Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil." That these people who say this prayer, they're not the self-sufficient ones. They're not the ones that are proud and think that they can do it on their own. Actually, they're the weak ones. They're the vulnerable ones. They're the ones that actually know they have a tendency to mess up. And the prayer starts, "Our Father." And again, this word "Father" would have been a familiar word to the Israelites. And whenever they said the word "Father," they would remember that God had chosen this nation by grace. That there was absolutely no reason why He had chosen in this particular nation, but He'd chosen them out of all the people and said, "I'm going to adopt you, that you are going to be mine. I'm going to identify myself with you." And they would understand that actually that they are a people established by grace, not by their own self-sufficiency. And within that context, it says, "Forgive us our debts as we have also forgiven our debtors." Two tales of total forgiveness, that we are totally and utterly forgiven, and that we get to tell the tales of, we get to share with other people that same forgiveness. So the first one, "Forgive us our debts." Now, this word debt, we didn't actually say it. We don't say it in the modern reading of the Lord's Prayer, but it's actually in the text, and it's a really important word because the people that Jesus would be speaking to were very poor people, that they would have been in the rural places, and they would have understood what he meant when he said debt, that debt would have been an absolutely terrifying thing for them. Because if you were in debt to someone, it wasn't just that you owed them money, it's but actually that they owned you, that you had become a slave to them. That you would lose some of your identity to them, that you would lose some of your authority and your power because you were owned by them. And therefore to be forgiven, as someone who has a debt, therefore to be forgiven was an outrageous gift. It was a gift of restoration. It was a gift of getting some of your humanity back. It was a gift of getting your dignity back, having your power restored. So when they said that, when Jesus said, like, you're forgiven that debt, it's like, actually, it's so much more. It's like, it would have been like totally and utterly mind-blowing. This, what he's offering us is restoration. That's what he's saying. He's offering us our dignity back, our humanity back. And I feel like sometimes when I speak, I always go on about Genesis. And the reason I go on about Genesis and so much is because it was the first book that in the education system, in the Jewish education system, it would have been the first book that they would have ever read. So it was a book that they were so totally and utterly familiar with. It would have just been soaked in their minds. So when they're talking about things of having your humanity and your dignity back, like it would have just been at the forefront of their minds. And it's fundamental then for us to understand what's going on and what's behind what they're automatically assuming that we might sometimes miss. And in Genesis 1, it says, then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created mankind in his image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground. There's a fundamental thing here that is so obvious we might even miss it. God created us. He is the creator. And when you create something, you get to make creative decisions over what that thing will look like. You get to choose, not the created thing. And he created us, and he chose what we look like. And when he chose what we look like, he said, I'm going to make you in my image. I'm going to make you in my likeness. What a privilege. Out of all the rest of creation, he said to human beings, I make you in my image. I make you in my likeness. He set us apart. He made us distinct from the rest of creation. And then more than that, he then said, and I give you a purpose. I give you a royal commission that you will look after this earth, that you will rule this earth, but you will do it in the way that I would. You represent me on this earth. That is our commission, our royal commission as human beings. And we're to do it in a way that is full of life and full of love, that brings flourishing to us and flourishing to others. And to not do that is basically a violation against our humanity. We become less human when we choose to not do it his way, when we say that actually I'm going to choose what I look like, I'm going to choose my own identity. And in Genesis 3, we see that. We see Adam and Eve choose to say, right, you know, I am made in your image, but I don't want to be made in your image. I want to be like a God. It's like, even though they were already made in the image of God, it's like, I want an independence. I choose that I will not look like that. And what we see is happens as that spirals out of control is that sin enters the story. And you see in Genesis 4, the first time the word is used, and the word is called shatat, it says, it's to Cain and Abel. So people are laughing at that point at the front row because it sounds like something else. So it wasn't that. If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? If you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must rule over it. There's this thing going on here where actually we are remembering that we are called to rule and to reign. It says actually you are called to rule over sin. But what ends up happening is that Cain ends up getting ruled over by sin. The very thing that he was meant to have power over, he then becomes held by, and he becomes a slave to. And that's effectively what happens when we sin, is that we become a slave to sin. When we were meant to rule over the chaos, when we were meant to subdue the chaos, as it says in Genesis 1, we suddenly become a slave to it. And we can have a funny relationship with sin, I think. I think some of us might are on different ends of the spectrum. I would put myself on the end of the spectrum, which would say that sometimes, actually, I kind of make sin not a big deal. That I can easily fool myself that, you know, it doesn't really matter about this, and I'll minimize the impact of sin. But actually, it matters what our sex life is like. It matters how much we drink. It matters if I'm jealous about people. It matters if I'm greedy. All that stuff matters because it's violating and distorting God's image in us and in other people. But then on the other end of the spectrum, we can sometimes give sin more power than it deserves. That we start to think that our sin can never be forgiven, that it's just going to rest on us, that we're going to be defined by it forever, and that we'll never be free from it. And then I say, like, he has totally and utterly forgiven you. And we told a story last week, or Rachel and Andy told a story last week of Jesus. And Jesus is at this house with a very important person. And he's sat there having dinner, and suddenly this woman comes in, and she's a woman with a reputation. Everyone knows her as a sinner. And she comes in, and as he sat there, she starts weeping over his feet, washing his feet, and wiping his feet with her hair, and pouring over an expensive perfume. It's an extravagant sign. And then everyone looks at her in utter disgust. And then Jesus says this: two people owed money to a certain moneylender. It's this thing of debt again. One owed him 500 denarii and the other 50. Neither of them had money to pay him back, so he forgave the debts of both. Now which of them will love him more? Simon replied, I suppose the one who has the bigger debt forgiven. You have judged correctly, Jesus said. Then he turned towards the woman and said to Simon, do you see this woman? She came into your house. You did not give me any water for my feet, but she wet my feet with her tears, and she wiped them with her hair. You did not give me a kiss, but this woman, from the time I entered, has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not pour oil on my head, but she has poured perfume on my feet. Therefore, I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven, as her great love has shown. But whoever has been forgiven loves little. Then Jesus said to her, your sins are forgiven. Now, wherever we sit on the end of the spectrum, whether we sit there and pretend that sin doesn't really matter, or that our sin is too powerful, like, this is good news. This is good news, because Jesus says that even though her sins are many, that she has been totally and utterly forgiven. And that those who have been forgiven much love more. And what I don't think that means is that we have to all go out and commit the most ridiculous sins in order for us to love God more. I think what it means is, it says, when you're aware, when you're fully aware of how much you've been forgiven, you can't help but love him. You can't help but want to pour perfume on his feet. You can't help but sit there at his feet and wash his feet with your tears. You can't help but do that. And I remember that when in the early years of being a Christian, the thing that made the difference for me, and I believed in God and for the first year, but it was like something shifted in me where my whole heart changed, my whole attitude changed, was that one day at church, and I can remember it so distinctly, is I went to church and I was just feeling heavy with my sin. I was just feeling like dirty and filthy. And I went forward for prayer, and it was just like this spirit filled me, and it was like just love poured into the depths of my soul. And after that, I was just like, I'm done. I'm totally undone. And I went up to my friend, and I was puffy, I was snotty, there was makeup everywhere because I hadn't learned to wear waterproof mascara. And I could barely walk. I was just shaking so much. And all I could say to my friend was, he loves me. He loves me. He loves me. And it was that encounter with grace which completely and utterly ruined me. And if you're struggling with loving God, if things are feeling like actually like the fire has gone cold, maybe actually it's about reconnecting with this thing of forgiveness. Maybe actually you've forgotten how much you've been forgiven. Maybe that's the way back into it, of coming to him and saying, God, is there anything in me that offends you? is there anything in me at the moment that I'm doing that actually where I'm violating your image in me? Come speak to me. Come and remind me of how much you've forgiven me. And God, would you forgive us? Would you forgive us for the ways that we distort and mar your image in us and the ways we do it to other people? Where we cause your heart pain and cause other people pain. That's our tale of total forgiveness. That's the tale we get to tell. That's the story we get to tell. What a story that we are totally and utterly forgiven. And the other tale we get to tell comes as it says, as we have also forgiven our debtors. Now, this is where I struggle. It doesn't say we will forgive our debtors, or one day when I feel ready to, I will forgive my debtors. It says, as we have, assuming that we will forgive our debtors, but we actually already have done it. And it does as well suggest that the two are linked, that as forgiveness enters, as grace enters our lives, while the natural response is then we have to share that with other people. How can we not share forgiveness as we have been forgiven? And again in Matthew, it says in Matthew 18, then Peter came to Jesus and asked, Lord, how many times shall I forgive my brother or sister who sins against me? Up to seven times? And Jesus answered, I tell you, not seven times, but 77 times. Therefore, the kingdom of heaven is like a king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. It's that thing of debt again. As he began the settlement, a man who owed him 10,000 bags of gold was brought to him. And since he was not able to pay, the master ordered that he and his wife and his children and all he had be sold to repay the debt. At this, the servant fell on his knees before him. Be patient with me, he begged, and I will pay back everything. And the servant's master took pity on him and cancelled the debt and let him go. But when the servant went out, he found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 silver coins, and he grabbed him and he began to choke him. Pay me back what you owe, he demanded. His fellow servant fell to his knees and begged him, be patient with me and I will pay you back. But he refused. Instead, he went off and had the man thrown into prison until he could pay back the debt. When the other servants saw what had happened, they were outraged and went and told their masters everything that had happened. Then the master called the servant in. You wicked servant, he said, I cancelled all the debt of yours because you begged me to. Shouldn't you have mercy on your fellow servant, just as I have had with you? Like this story, like sometimes Jesus' parables are really cryptic and we can't quite work out what he's trying to say. But this one could not be more obvious. It's saying to us, like, how can you, who've received total and utter forgiveness, not extend it to other people? And I know that is painful and I know it is tough. But when we freely receive this gift of undeserved love, of undeserved forgiveness, he asks us to then share that with other people. And there's real wisdom in Matthew 7 when Jesus is talking about forgiveness again. And he says, if you see a speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and you want to help them out, then why don't you first go and deal with the plank that is in your own eye? First deal with that plank and then you can get to business on the sawdust in their eye. And I think what he's trying to say is like consider your sin worse than your brother's, because if you deal with that first, well, then you're going to be so much more tender with your brother. He's not saying never touch their eye, but he's saying like deal with your own stuff and then you'll be tender with other people. And we're tender with other people just as he is tender with us. When we realize that actually the plank in our own eye is so big and we feel the pain and we experience the grace of having that taken out, well, then we deal tenderly and mercifully with other people. And that is all well and good, isn't it? Until we really do encounter something where it feels like the other person doesn't have a speck but a plank, or they are a plank. And how do we forgive them? How do we forgive when it hurts so, so deeply? And forgiveness doesn't mean that we forget what they've done. It doesn't mean that it just disappears. And it doesn't mean that we give them free rein to continue doing what they're doing and continue to do it again. But it does mean that we relinquish our right for justice, for revenge, and where they've caused pain, to inflict pain on them. That's what it means. It means rather than speaking curses over them, to speak blessing over them. And this all feels incredibly real to me at the moment, because over the last 2 weeks, I've probably had the worst 2 weeks of my life. Somebody hurt a member of my family in such a harsh and horrible way. And all I've wanted to do is seek revenge. All I've wanted to do is inflict pain on that person, because it's just so wrong what they have done. I mean, the worst I got to was actually going into when I was in their house, taking their really expensive shower gel and pouring some of it down the drain. My mum was even worse. She crushed Cheerios into their dirty washing. We're dealing with it really maturely, obviously. I have repented from that, but it's still quite funny. They don't know that. Anyway, they will discover soon. But what has terrified me, and what I've really wrestled with over the last 2 weeks, is that I thought I was someone who was really loving. I thought, like, I genuinely do love people, but I've been terrified by the hatred that is in my heart. I've been terrified by it, of how much I've wanted to inflict pain on this person. And the thing that I've realized, the place that I've come to, is that if I don't forgive, if I don't speak blessing over this person, well, then the only person that's going to end up hurting is me. It's going to be me that's walking around with bitterness and hatred and resentment in my heart. That person is not going to necessarily affect them whether I forgive them or not, but it's going to affect me. And I just can't afford that for my family. My family can't afford to live under that. So we have to forgive them. And I bet there's people in here that when we talk about forgiving people, there's someone that comes to mind where actually you know you haven't forgiven that person. Maybe it's something big. Or maybe it's actually more subtle, in that it's little things that have been building up, and sometimes we don't even notice it, that someone does something and it stings, and then they do it again and it stings, and we do it again and it builds up and it builds up and it builds up. Like, we have to forgive. We have to live free people. And the only way we're going to live free people is if we forgive. And it sometimes feels incredibly hard. It sometimes feels so tough that we just think it's impossible. And when I did this talk this morning, there was a woman who got up at the end who said that she'd been sexually abused by her father. And the idea of forgiving felt impossible, but God had made it possible, and he'd actually ended up coming to know Jesus. It was an incredible story of redemptive forgiveness. And she said the only way that she was able to do that was by the Holy Spirit. And when we do this, when we live a life where we're constantly keeping a short account with God, well, then we live free. Then we get to tell a tale that I live totally free, that I'm completely and utterly forgiven. And only he has the right to forgive my sins. Only he has the authority to tell me that. So therefore, when he says, Anna, your sins are forgiven, my sins are forgiven. And if we're going to live free people, then we live free by forgiving people, by releasing people, by relinquishing our right to judge them, to inflict pain on them, to take revenge. And we begin to start speaking blessing over them rather than curses. And these are tales that we get to participate in on a daily basis. We get to daily be forgiven. And that is grace at work in our lives.